across the country and around the world, this is TalkZone.com, the best in Internet talk radio. We're back on TalkZone for more Our Global Hope, world-changing leadership talk with your host, Dr. Henrik Mann.
If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Henrik Mann, and we're back with our guest, Mr. John Perkins. And John, we're talking about your book, Hoodwinked, and in one of the chapters, you discuss the issue of Iran, and I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners some of your thoughts about Iran and the swirling clouds.
Well, yeah, you know, it's a very interesting case in Iran. I spent a lot of time in Iran in the 70s. I worked for the Shah in those days, and blindly we were pretty innocent as to all the tragedy that was under the surface that was going on during the Shah's regime. It's a case in point of I never spoke Farsi well at all, and so many people working for big corporations, working for USAID and other organizations go to these countries, don't really speak the language, and therefore they're only influenced by the people who speak English. And under the Shah, those people all work for the Shah. So we get a very one-sided point of view. On the other hand, when I go to Latin America, I speak Spanish pretty fluently. You can get all sorts of viewpoints. Real case that needs to be made for when people work in other countries, they need to speak the language. But in any case, today what we're seeing in Iran is a country that has always felt itself to be a power in the Middle East, and still does. It feels that it exercises a great deal of authority, which it does, in fact. You know, it's really a lot of the support behind Hamas and a lot of the Arab organizations comes from Iran. They have a lot more control than we realize. A lot of it's a very subtle type of control. Iran's been very good at subtleties over the years. And I think the United States needs to understand the position that Iran is in. It's obviously in conflict with a lot of our own values around how women are treated, around so many sort of religious, spiritual things. And yet we really need to take a good, hard look at what Iran's relationship is in the Middle East. I think when we put so much at stake in defending Israel, we're forgetting some of the other problems in other parts of the Middle East, and we really need to look at the whole Middle East together for Israel's sake as well as for everyone else's sake, because it's a tinderbox, and it's going to continue to explode unless somehow we're able to come to grips with this problem that's faced there.
You know, John, I have a picture in my computer of Dick Cheney with Saddam Hussein back in, I think, the 80s, maybe in the 70s. It's amazing to me that we can have presidential level leaders who have been involved and probably are involved to this day, whether it's Democrat or Republican, in working with different dictators, and that human rights values are really completely beside the point. Is that your sense? And feel free to comment on Dick Cheney if you want.
Well, it absolutely is. You know, if Saddam Hussein had gone along with economic hitmen, if he had bought the same deal that the House of Saud bought in Saudi Arabia, and I talk about that extensively in my books, how I was one of the people who set up this deal with Saudi Arabia, and then we tried to sell the same deal to Saddam Hussein. He didn't buy it. If he had, he'd still be president of Iraq, and just as the House of Saud is still running Saudi Arabia. If he had bought into our deal, if he had gone along with Dick Cheney, he'd still be running that country, and we'd be dealing with him as though he was the greatest guy in the world. We'd be selling him all the weapons he wants, but he didn't. He didn't give in to us, and I'm not sure why, frankly. So he's gone. But it's a great case in point that we basically, our administrations typically defend any country and any leader who will allow our corporations to exploit the country. And any leader that will not allow that to happen, we do everything in our power to get rid of. We talked about Zelaya earlier. That we can mention Mossadegh of Iran. We can mention Arbenz of Guatemala, Roldos of Ecuador, Torrijos of Panama, and on. There's a huge list of presidents, many of them democratically elected, who we overthrew or assassinated because they would not allow our corporations to continue to exploit their resources, including their human resources.
John, do you name names in Hoodwinked, like possibly Halliburton that Cheney is connected to, or other companies that are specifically, maybe Chevron, I don't know, just companies that that are effecting economic policy for their own gain and are not above using corruption as a tool to get their way?
Well, I do. I name a lot of names, and the two companies you just mentioned are two of those, Halliburton and Chevron, and many, many others that are deeply involved in this. Of course, today we've got the whole financial business, the Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and the companies that have brought us into this financial disaster in such a major way. General Electric, I talk a lot about them in Hoodwinked, and the leaders of those companies who are constantly in cahoots and who, incidentally, are making a hell of a lot of money off the rest of us during this recession. And what we're just hearing today, that we may be coming out of the recession, that it looks like GNP is going to be growing, which means we're technically coming out of the recession. At the same time, we're hearing that we have the highest unemployment rates in 25 years. So what this is telling us is that GNP is growing, but it's growing because of a few bankers, a few very, very wealthy people are making a lot of money, and they're investing their money back in the economy, but they're not hiring people. And people's and houses are still being people are still being foreclosed on for their houses. So what we're seeing is a very unrealistic view of true economy. GNP, as it turns out, measures primarily those things which are impacted by the rich and powerful increasingly in our country. And so the sense that we're coming out of the recession is a very false sense. In fact, we're coming out, the rich are coming out of the recession. The poor are going deeper into the recession. And until we turn this thing around and get rid of this mutant form of capitalism, we're going to continue to see that sort of thing happen. We must turn this economy around, create a new type of economy that's based on the idea that corporations can make profits, but only within the context of creating a sustainable, just, and peaceful world. We can only make profits if we're socially and environmentally responsible. And incidentally, that's not a new idea. For 100 years, no corporate in the United States, in the first 100 years of the United States history as a country, no corporation could get a charter unless it could prove that it was there to serve the public interest.
John, when I think about our new president, President Obama, and him inheriting a financial mess, and yet right now it seems that you know, many people could wonder, based on the thesis of your book, that nobody gets elected president who doesn't have strings attached to the corporatocracy. That is, that it doesn't matter whether it's a Reagan or an Obama or someone in between. They all serve corporatocracy interests. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. You know, we've seen that Goldman Sachs was the largest financial contributor to the Obama campaign. Citigroup was close behind. Huge corporations contributed to his campaign, despite what he said at the beginning. Makes him very beholden to them. Here's an example, and we've talked about Honduras. Well, it's interesting that Eric Holder, who is Obama's attorney general, was one of the lead attorneys for Dole, for Chiquita in Colombia. Colombia took Chiquita to court, accused Chiquita of hiring assassination squads to take out union leaders. And Eric Holder was the main defender of Chiquita. He lost, incidentally, and Chiquita admitted that they had hired organizations that are officially classified by the U.S. government as terrorist organizations. They ended up paying a large fine in Colombia. But so suddenly, Obama comes into office. There's this crisis in Honduras. It's instigated by Chiquita, and his own attorney general has extremely close ties to Chiquita. This is typical. Under both Republicans and Democrats, we have this revolving door policy where you get people at the highest levels of government who are totally beholden to and connected with big corporations, still major stockholders in corporations. We saw it with Cheney, with Halliburton, yes, but we're seeing it tremendously also in this current administration. What that tells us, I think more than anything, Henrik, is that it comes back to we the people. It is not the president that's going to create change. We the people have to do it. I'm so often reminded of the story that Franklin Roosevelt told, that he came out of a meeting in the 30s with union leaders, and at the end of the meeting he said to the union leaders, listen, I think you know now that I agree with you. Now you got to go out there and force me to do the right thing. He realized, as I'm sure Obama does, that the powers of the status quo are so strong that it's up to we, the people, to force our presidents and the heads of our corporations and all our other politicians to do the right thing. It always comes from we, the people. We must get off our butts, stop watching so damn much television, and get out there and sure. demand change.
You know, when you talk about the solution area, I wanted to leave it till the fourth segment, but let's go for it right now. You identify five action areas in your book that have to do with a new solution, and they include adopting attitudes that encourage good stewardship, creating a new economy, accepting consumer responsibility, implementing new rules for business and government, and honoring our individual passions for making a difference. Can you, in just a couple of minutes here, kind of summarize what you mean by each of those?
Sure. Well, which one do you want me to start with?
How about encouraging good stewardship?
Yeah. When I was in business school in the 60s, my professors all taught us that a good CEO, a good manager, is like a loyal soldier. He's looking out for the best long-term interests of the organization, its employees, its consumers, its suppliers, everyone. He's not out just to win the battle, but he's out to win the long-term war. And I think that's all changed shortly after that period of time, where CEOs today don't look at themselves as loyal soldiers. They look at themselves as mercenaries. And basically, they're out to make as much money for themselves as they possibly can. And to hell with the consumers and their employees. I mean, look at a guy like Jack Welch, who's often held up as this great hero of management.
Right.
Jack Welch fired, laid off more than a quarter of General Electric's employees. He said he's making it leaner and meaner. Well, he certainly made it meaner. He laid off a quarter of his employees, and he gave himself huge bonuses and raises at the same time. He also took GE from being essentially a manufacturing company into being a financial services company, kind of led the way into this economy that we're in today, where we don't make much at all. We just do acquisitions and derivatives and mergers. Very, very unhealthy. And so Jack Welch was not a good steward at all. We need to get back to this idea that a good steward is someone who looks out for the long-term interests of his organization and all of its employees and its customers and its suppliers, and that all of these things are interrelated.
Well, I want to talk more with you about that in our final segment. As we go to our third break, I want to remind our listeners to look us up at www.ourglobalhope.com, and we'll be right back with John Perkins for more world-changing leadership talk.